Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you with us today as we visit with Lee Reich. He is a PhD in horticulture, author of a number of gardening books, and his latest is The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. You may have some gardening questions. I hope you do, and I hope you'll give us a call if you do. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. We would love to hear from you. And Lee Reich with us by phone. Hi, Lee. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, we probably all use a little natural science in our gardening, even though we might not think about it that way.
Hopefully. It does help. It really lets you know what's going on and how you can change what's happening if needed.
Yeah. And so why this particular book?
Well, I guess it all started one day. I was out in my garden making compost. And as I was making compost, I started thinking of how I wasn't randomly just throwing stuff in the compost pile, but I was really consciously and subconsciously thinking back to what I learned. I have a couple of graduate degrees in agriculture, and I've gardened for many years. I've spoken to a lot of gardeners. I keep up with the science of gardening, and I was thinking how everything I was doing really, as I said, consciously and subconsciously, was drawing on that science as well as just practical experience, and I make pretty good compost. And I was thinking how this could be applied to a lot of things in gardening. Knowing a little of the science makes it more interesting, makes the garden better, and very important these days, it makes for a more resilient garden or gardener, because with climate often sort of being wacky, or what seems wacky these days, what you've been doing for maybe years in the garden and always worked, you might have to change what you do, and understanding how plants work and how what's going on in the soil can help you know how to change.
And as I was looking through the book, there were, you know, things that I thought, well, I've done that, but I hadn't really considered why or what, why it makes a difference, or in other cases, I could change that practice and make things better. So in those senses, I was really interested and happy to see your book.
Oh, good. Thanks.
Yeah.
Hopefully a lot of people have.
I bet. And, well, just before we go to the phones and take calls, talk about how the book is organized.
So it's organized by different sort of areas of gardening. Like I have a whole chapter on propagation and planting. What's going on when you try and propagate plants, you know, how to hardening off plants, things like that. I have a whole chapter on flowering and fruiting, what makes fruits happen, how to make more fruits happen, things like that. Another chapter similar to flower and fruiting, but it's on stems and leaves. This is, vegetative growth versus flowering and fruiting is reproductive growth. And stems and leaves is one of my favorite chapters because it has a lot of mention there about pruning. And people often a little either too nervous to prune or too wild in their pruning. And I think it's really important if you know what your goals are in pruning and you know how plants react to pruning, to different types of pruning, you can really direct the plant growth the way you want. And the nice thing about it is you see the effect, often the same season. I thought that was quite interesting. A chapter on organizations, how plants are grouped together, plant families, and all the scientific concepts that I talk about. By each subheading in the chapter has a scientific concept, and then they're all concepts that have direct practical applications. So I explain the concept, then I say, here is how you can apply it in the garden. And there's one on stress, which, you know, plants, especially with climate change, plants undergo a lot of stress from heat, from drought. The senses, this is like flavor, aroma. Flavor was the final part of the book, just because it's one that touches everyone has one reason that a lot of people grow vegetables and fruits. What surely the reason I do, and I did a little segue in that chapter into terroir.
Right? Yes.
Terroir, which is a term that people like to banter about and, you know, just talk about what it is. And I don't want to give anything away, but the validity of it.
There we go. Well, it's a great approach. And I like the fact that you've got the science, but then you also have, here's how we practically, how I can carry these things out and have success with my garden. So I like that approach a lot. You mentioned planting and, that's in your first chapter. And Kate in Menasha has a question about planting.
Okay.
So let's go to Kate. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say the book sounds amazing. I love this show. I always have so many questions. So thanks for taking my call. I am a new dahlia planter, and I planted some last year. They grew fantastically with a little bone meal and compost. The bulbs survived the winter, and I put them in the ground, and amazingly, it looks like they're growing. But I have a question about those bulbs or roots, whatever they are. In their first year, they multiplied tremendously, so that what I planted this spring, and I planted them all because this is my first time replanting them, it looks like a bunch of potatoes, you know, just like a huge lump of potatoes that I planted. I wonder, should I have split those up, or can I do that next year? What do I do with those great big dahlia roots?
Well, you could have split them up, and each one, pretty soon you might be giving away dahlias or be in the dahlia business, because each one of those tubers can give rise to a whole new plant. And I believe if you do not divide them and you just keep planting them, they'll probably get very crowded wherever you plant them, and the plants will survive, but they'll probably make smaller and smaller flowers until they're separated, and then you give each one enough elbow room.
Yeah. Makes good sense. So there you go, Kate. You can next year go ahead and divide them and put them in somewhere else, or give them out or sell them. There you go.
And just one other thing that some other listeners, when you said they overwintered, you mean they overwintered? You dug them up and brought them indoors to overwinter, because they will not overwinter outdoors there.
Correct. Apparently I did it right, because they didn't die, so I was very happy. I just have one question. When I split those, can I just tear them apart, or do I have to cut them, or how delicate are they?
I mean, I would probably, either one would work, but generally plant tissue heals better with less surface area exposed, and if you cut it, a clean cut exposes less surface area than a ragged break when you just break them apart. So I would just cut them.
There you go, Kate. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, from flowers, let's turn to vegetables for a minute. Yvonne and Shatek, your turn. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi. I love your show. I listen faithfully every Friday, even Saturday morning. So here's my question. I have a friend that told me that they were reading in the newspaper last week that one should never, ever use wood mulch in their tomato plant bed. And I don't know where the source was. I asked what's the source or who was writing it and different conditions, and they didn't know, but they went home and took all the wood mulch away or off their tomato bed. And I've used it for years successfully, and I'm wondering if there's something new in the tomato world that I need to know about.
Maybe you know something about this, Larry, but I've never heard this, and I can't see any reason why it would be bad.
The reason it might be bad is if you had wood chips, let's say, from the city, Okay, and amongst those wood chips were black walnut trees or any relative of the walnut. It would have an impact on tomatoes. That's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, I'm thinking that the wood, in my experience in reading, the wood of the black walnut won't cause that sensitivity in tomatoes and related plants, but I think, and I could be wrong, the fresh leaves, sort of rain leaching stuff out of the fresh leaves or exudates from the roots, living roots. I remember once I had gotten a whole bunch of, I have a friend that's a woodworker, and he had a whole bunch of black walnut he was working with, and he had a lot of shavings. And I mulched my blueberries with wood shavings, but I had all these black walnut shavings. I really like my blueberries, but I really like to put shavings down for them. And I was a little wary about it. I was thinking that, I'd hate to kill my blueberries. But anyway, I put it down, and there was no effect.
So it was okay for you. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, not 100%, that the wood, which is not a living part of the plant, should be okay.
And, as it decomposes, it's going to bind up some nitrogen, perhaps, so that might, over time, limit tomato growth. What do you think, Lee?
I hate to be so contrary.
Well, that's all right. Be contrary.
This is one of my pet peeves when people, because there's a thing, so wood chips are very high in carbon and low in nitrogen, and when they're added to the soil, the bacteria that break it down and the fungi, they need to take nitrogen from the soil to balance out that excess carbon and gobble it up. So they're better than plants are at using that nitrogen. So if you dig wood chips into the soil, there will be a temporary nitrogen tie-up and your plants will have a nitrogen deficiency. But when you lay it on top of the soil as a mulch, the decomposition occurs just at that interface of the bottom of the mulch and the top of the soil, and it's very slow, and it's about at the rate where the nitrogen's re-released into the soil, and so you don't get a nitrogen tie-up. And this is that's the science behind it. The practice is, I've done this for decades, and I've spoken to many other people who've done this for decades, and so you do get a nitrogen tie-up, as you said, if you dig it into the soil, but if you just lay it on top of the soil, you should not. I guess there might be some extreme case if you had a soil that was so poor in nitrogen and you added it, if it's such an infertile soil that perhaps exists somewhere, maybe that would happen then. But yeah. Generally, it does not happen.
Okay. Yvonne, I got us off on tracks here a little bit. Did your questions get answered?
I think so. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay. Lee, we're probably going to be doing this all show, and actually, that's a fun way to do a show. To be perfectly honest, I'll keep at it.
I like it. So hopefully, I'm not offending anyone.
let's talk about tomatoes for just a minute. When you do you provide a mulch to your tomatoes when you have them in the garden?
Oh. Do I?
Yes.
Actually, I have in the past, in some parts of my garden I do, but generally I go to grow tomatoes. I've practiced no-till for a number of reasons. One is that it cuts down weed problems in my vegetable garden for literally decades. So I don't till the soil ever, and the way I enrich it every year and keep weeds that might blow in from germinating is I apply a mulch on all the vegetable beds. And that mulch happens to be compost. So there's compost there, and then I just plant in the compost. It's a mulch. It also feeds the soil. It also smothers weeds. And I guess some years I put something on top of the compost, but generally not.
Generally not. Lee Reich.
I'm a big fan of mulching, though.
Yeah, me too. Lee Reich, our guest today. He is the author of The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. Dave Potratz, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. What questions do you have about your garden? What are you curious about? Lee Reich, author of The Ever Curious Gardener, our guest today here on Garden Talk. Great to have him on by phone today. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll take another call. Mayor Marty in Douglas County, it's your turn. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering if your guest could spell his last name, and then I do have a question. We have a lilac bush we planted about 20 years ago. It's maybe 8 feet tall. It's kind of leggy. It's tall rather than wide and bushy. And as much as we have tried to figure out a way we shouldn't do this, we have to dig it up. It's going to be in the way of something. How can I take part of it and transplant that?
Okay, well, the first part of the question is easy. My name is spelled, last name is spelled R-E-I-C-H, and first name is Lee, L-E-E. And the second part is not too hard. So the lilac bush that you want to move, if you take enough soil, you can move the whole bush, although it would be better to do it when it's dormant. But you can also, the way a lilac grows, it sends out sort of little underground runners, and over time, gets wider and wider. And what you can do is around the outside of the bush, some small shoots, you could dig into the soil and cut in towards where the mother plant is, and you might be able to get a shoot with some roots attached and get a small plant from that for replanting. Or you could even be more dramatic and just sort of take some, like an axe or something, and I don't know if you want to save the original plant, but take an axe and really chop into more within the bush and chop down into the plant to separate it and take a big clump of shoots with the roots. It is actually better to do all this when the plant's dormant, because if you dig it up now, it's unavoidably going to lose some roots in proportion to the tops. So it's going to lose water probably. It'll need a lot of, consistent watering to get it reestablished. And even then, until it has roots, the watering doesn't do that much. Yeah. So ideally wait, but it is possible to do it.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Marty. Appreciate it. And Kit in Mount Horeb, it's your turn.
Hello, Dr. Reich.
Hello.
Dr. Kit. Reich. Is this the famous Dr. Reich?
It is the famous Dr. Reich.
I'm making a joke, Larry. Lee Reich is an old friend of mine from college days. I have a question for you, though. I've been saving the same seeds from my tomato plants for 25 years and planting them in the same beds for 25 years. I have 96 plants in the ground right now, and I was wondering if you can describe tomato blight, because some people say what I have is blight, although I get plenty of tomatoes.
Well, there's two kinds of tomato blight. There's early blight and late blight, and you can get one or both of them. And the early blight, both of them put splotches on the leaves, actually different kinds of splotches. And early blight is somewhat, I know for my tomato plants, it's inevitable, and I just sort of, they do bear, and I don't do anything about it. And, just get a lot of tomatoes, and I get some amount of blight. The late blight actually does not overwinter in Wisconsin. It overwinters in the south and then hitchhikes north if you have the right wind and humidity conditions. So it doesn't always occur, although sometimes it occurs. I don't know if it happened out in Wisconsin, but here in the east, in the northeast, there was a lot of late blight a few years ago because some of the big box stores had plants that were grown in the south, and I guess they were infected plants. And then once the infection's here, it can spread from, neighbors' plants to, around to other places. So,
late blight is a reality here.
Oh, always?
Not always.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it does show up, but the early blight always shows up.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And I guess the thing to do with it, Kit, I would say do what you're always doing, since you're not doing it totally right, planting tomatoes in the same place every year. But if you're getting a lot of tomatoes, that's good.
Yeah, I wouldn't If it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of thing there. He brings up something, though, that you cover in your book, which I thought was kind of fun and interesting to read about, and that's saving heirloom seeds. Now, Kit probably saves heirloom seeds. Talk about that a little bit.
Right. I know he does save heirloom seeds because I sent him the seeds.
There you go.
They're very tomato seeds. Tomatoes are actually generally really easy to grow. They grow pretty, despite, you know, late blight, early blight, and there's actually another disease, Septoria leaf spot, that's, you know, pretty common on tomatoes. But besides all that, they're quite easy to grow. I always consider them to grow almost like weeds. And the seeds are really easy to save. Basically, if you have a tomato that's an heirloom tomato, which means the seeds will bear the same kinds of fruits as the one you got the seed from. You can just squeeze out the seeds, mix them with some water, let them ferment, because each seed has a germination inhibitor around it. It's like this gel, and you can just let it sit in water for a few days, and it'll ferment off that gel, and then dry them out, save them, plant them again, and you can do that every year. And it's easy. And the nice thing about it is, if you go to a farmer's market and you buy some heirloom tomatoes and you really like the taste of them and you don't know what the variety is, or maybe the farmer doesn't know, you can just save the seeds from it and you'll have the variety. You won't know the name of it, but you get the fruit.
Who cares? I mean, if the fruit's good, right. You like it.
You can make up a name for it, and that's why some heirlooms have multiple names, because people make up names in there.
Oh, boy. David in Palmyra. Well, let's go to you next. Hi, David.
Hello. I got a question. I have a raspberry patch, and I've gotten, I believe it's spiderwing astrophila larvae that we're growing at last year, and it's, like, decimated my whole crop, and it's just destroyed our family because we love our raspberries. I don't know how can we get rid of them.
Well, spiderwing astrophila is near and dear to, well, not dear to my heart, but it's near to my heart because I grow a lot of blueberries. And they also attack blueberries and raspberries, which I grow also. But spider-winged drosophila, for anybody that affectionately known as SWD, is a type of fruit fly that some of you might remember that from high school biology. You grow it on bananas and things like that. Most fruit flies eat ripe or preferably overripe fruit. Spider-winged drosophila is bad in that it eats underripe fruit. And this is a new pest. I'm actually hoping sometime in the next few years that there's going to be some natural predator of it that's going to move in. Until then, there are some things you can do. One thing is, if you harvest, most of my experiences with blueberries, this is if you harvest very frequently, you know, obviously ripe fruit, and you whisk the fruit into the refrigerator for 2 days, it will kill the larvae that might be in the fruit. So don't look too closely when you eat, because there will be some larvae in them. Not that noticeable, but you know, the fruit still tastes good. So that's one way to kill them. There are some organic pesticides that are labeled for it, but you have to use it strictly according to the label. One is called Entrust, and it's not cheap, but two sprays of that can control it. Also, I don't know if you're talking about summer-bearing or fall-bearing raspberries, but on blueberries, at least, they don't show up here, and my climate is very similar to yours. They don't show up here until early August, or they don't become really prominent until early August. So if you grow early varieties, like if you're growing raspberries, if you switch to summer raspberries rather than fall raspberries, that would probably, you'd have less Drosophila on them. And what else?
That's something that's being recommended here, for sure.
Oh, right. And there is actually traps that people are developing to monitor them and also to even control them. For the past couple of years, I've been working with Cornell. I used to work for Cornell with some traps that actually have a bait on it. You hang it in the plants or near the plants, and then the insect is attracted to it, and then it kills it or it gets stuck on it. So I think there's hope. And between planting early varieties, worst comes to worst, you can spray this Entrust. Although, you know, berries you know, I've grown berries for so long without having any spray at all on them. That's really a last resort, and most years I won't even bother if I can get around spraying them. If you look on the internet also, there's a way you could make a homemade monitoring trap with yeast and sugar and the design of the trap that you'll find in a lot of places. But this is good just to see what, and sort of interesting. This is one thing I think the nice thing about gardening, and one of the reasons I wrote my book is because I think the science is really interesting. So the science of you can start trapping for monitoring to see when the spider-winged Drosophila comes out, and then maybe take action or, you know, do harvesting or spreading when they become prevalent.
David, thanks again. Gene, a certified arborist in Wisconsin, emailed in to say that in addition to possible toxicity from black walnut chips, many carry verticillium wilt. Most common maple and other species can be problematic for tomatoes and other Solanaceae plants.
I'm wondering if the wilt would be in the chips, though.
That's what
I mean, I don't know, but I have to say that one of my philosophies for gardening, especially food gardening, is to grow a lot of different things. So I grow a lot of different types of fruits, and I grow a lot of different types of vegetables, and I am pretty loose with, like, and sometimes you read that don't put this in the compost, because it might, diseased leaves in the compost or pest-ridden leaves. And basically, I throw everything into my compost, and I mulch. I usually have this big sign out in front of my house, wood chips wanted, and I'll just throw any wood chips on my garden. And I guess worst-case scenario is something bad happens. I have so many different types of fruits and vegetables that it might knock out one thing, but I got a lot of other stuff.
There you go.
And it hasn't happened. I'm trying to think if I've ever, I've never suffered a really, I mean, the worst thing that happened in my garden, perhaps most gardens, just weather, for fruits, some late frost or something like that, which it's hard to do anything about.
Yeah, but Lee, remember, you've only been doing this for 30 years or so.
Actually, 45 years.
Oh, boy.
I hate to admit it. I started as an adult, so.
Jim in Stone Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I was reading my book of outdoor gardening yesterday about applying mulch, and it said don't do it while the soil is cool. Only do it after it's warmed up, because it'll stop the soil from warming up.
That's a good idea. If you're planting something that needs warm soil, like vegetables, when you want to get planted in the spring, you definitely should. If you want the earliest planting, you don't want mulch on the soil. That reminds me of one of my first gardens in Madison. I used to every year collect leaves from neighbors, and in the fall, and I'd put them, a foot deep in my garden. And then, as you said, I wanted the soil to warm up early. So then I would take all the leaves off, pile them up somewhere, and then once the soil is warmed up and you want the effect of mulch, what I would do is take all the leaves, put them back on the soil. So I was a lot younger then when I was doing that, moving a lot of leaves back and forth. I don't do that anymore.
There you go.
I actually apply a lot of leaves now, but I use it, berry bushes and fruit trees and plants like that are perennial woody plants that they don't need the soil warmed up.
So Jim, what you heard was correct, for sure. Thanks for that call. Janine in Eau Claire, what's on your mind?
Hi. Lately, I heard the garden show, and somebody said that you shouldn't put your potatoes and tomatoes together, and I had already I'm container gardening this year. I had already put a potato and a tomato in a pot together, and so now I'm worried about what will happen.
Well, they do share pests, but, I guess along the same line of reasoning, you shouldn't put tomatoes and tomatoes together either. Tomatoes share pests. The only the only rationale I could see for that would be, you know, I talked about late blight when Kit called. And late blight, not only can it hitchhike up from the south, but it can, the only place it can overwinter this far north is on potato tubers that have blight on them. So if you had, say, in your garden potatoes and they got late blight and then you saved the tubers to replant, that would be a source of late blight. And then if you had tomatoes near them or other potatoes, they're going to get the late blight. But generally, if, you know, if you're buying potatoes for planting, they should be okay, and I wouldn't worry about planting them together.
All right. There we go. Thanks for calling in. Kate in Pewaukee.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had bought tomato plants at a greenhouse, and when I set them out in raised what were fertilizer tubs, and I've grown my garden in that for, you know, many years. I set the tomatoes out, and like the next day, something had eaten the main part of each of the tomato plants off. I don't know what got up into the pot to do that. And I'm wondering, will they produce any tomatoes, or do I need to go get some more plants?
Are the leaves all gone, or?
No, there's this, like, the little side branches are still there, but the whole main part of the plant.
The top part, you're saying?
Yep.
Oh. What do you think, Lee?
How tall were the plants? How tall was the portion that was cut back, like 6 inches or?
Probably about 6 inches.
And how tall are the side branches?
The side branches are up about 5 inches from the ground, and they are probably about 5 inches long.
Okay.
I would say that the plants are going to be fine. I mean, they have a little setback. Anytime you prune some leaves off a plant, it cuts back photosynthesis, which is, you know, what makes energy for the plant. But I would say they'll be okay. My main concern would be that whatever creature did this is going to come back and do it again.
Yeah, could be a, well, that high, well, 5-6 inches, could be a squirrel, I suppose, or a rabbit.
Yeah, I generally like to blame everything on squirrels, but it could be, you know, rabbit, could be deer.
Yeah, could be. So there you go, Kate. I'd give it a try. Let watch them for a while and see what happens. You know,
how about like a chicken wire cylinder around, you know, going a certain height to just keep them back until, you know, when the plants are really young and lush, there's a lot of critters that will munch on them that wouldn't normally eat that once they get bigger.
Yeah, that'd be worth it, Kate. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim Nguyen, who's a horticulturist here at the UW-Madison, he's one that is loath to take leaves off of tomato plants, for example, because just as you said, that's where you get your photosynthesis.
Right. It's interesting, and I don't do this either, but I'm thinking of doing the early blight, one way that people commercially, I guess, this, I think a lot of farmers do this, is the lower leaves to promote better air circulation on steak tomatoes, you know, ones that are trained up. People pull off some of the lower leaves.
Yeah, that could make some sense. You can join in too, by the way. We're going to go to Jeanette next in Weston, but there's a line open for you at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Talking with Lee Reich today. His latest book is called The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. Fascinating book, and one that any gardener can make some use of for sure. Now let's go to Jeanette in Weston. Jeanette, thank you for calling.
Yeah, say, I was wondering about these black beetles. I just got them last year. And they did my grapes, and they went and they ate the leaves on the grapes, and they also spotted the grapes. And I tried to catch them and hold them in my hand, and they bit me, so I threw them down. But there for a while.
We lost her.
Yeah, grapes don't generally have a lot of insect diseases. They mostly have, this might have stumped me here. Let me think. Could turn to one of my other books. Let me take a quick look.
we'll take a look. There's an insect that just munches on grapes. And roses. And roses. Right. What's that?
Hello?
Yeah, I'm there.
Yeah, it would not be Japanese beetles.
Yes.
Too early for them.
Yeah, it's too early for them, but they certainly feed on grapes and so forth. And they're not all black either. I'm not sure.
Right.
If it was all black...
Let's see, I have a book here with,
let Lee take a look at that, as we visit about gardening today. Lee Reich, our guest, author of The Ever Curious Gardener. I'm Larry Mueller, here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lee Reich, author of The Ever Curious Gardener. Just looking at the book jacket, and it says, join acclaimed gardener, scientist, and author Lee Reich on a journey through the delights of your garden in this laugh-out-loud treasure on the scientific wonders of plants and soils, offering eye-opening insight and practical guidance. And coverage includes, and among other things as mentioned, is how to maximize both flavor and nutrition in your garden bounty. And you do talk about that, Lee.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons a lot of us garden, or one of the main reasons.
What are some tips for maximizing flavor?
Geez, I wish you hadn't asked me that, because it's so complex flavor.
I know.
To really put it into the science, I looked through a lot of literature on this, and there's only two vegetables, basically, that you could say anything consistent about, or somewhat consistent. One was onions. So, Vidalia onions, the sweet onions they grow in Vidalia County, Texas. I mean, Georgia.
Georgia, yeah.
So onions... Or there's a lot of ways to get the maximum. The maximum you want is sweet onions. There's a lot of ways to do that. One, and this is generally true for most fruits and vegetables, and is a good reason for growing them on your own home grounds, because you can choose the best varieties. And probably the main determinant for good flavor in fruits and vegetables is choice of variety. So that's one thing. And then with onions, there is another big factor, and that's the amount of sulfur in the soil, because high sulfur soils give make for very pungent onions. So unfortunately, if you have a high sulfur soil, there's no easy way to make it low sulfur. But if you have a low sulfur soil and you really like hot onions, don't grow a variety that's sweet. And add sulfur to the soil. I don't think there'd be many people trying to get the hottest possible onions. So that was one thing. And the other thing that there's been a lot of research on is carrots. Interesting, a lot of that research is at the University of Wisconsin.
Yes.
And the thing is about flavor is you have to take into account climate. You have to take into account soil. Take into account temperatures, all these things. There's a lot of factors that can influence the flavor, with carrots especially. And I guess to sum up, the way to get the best flavor in carrots is, one, choose a good tasting variety, and the second thing, not all that practical, is move to California. Really good. California produces really good flavored carrots, and I believe that the reason is probably because they have such mild winters, and in California, you can actually plant carrots in the fall and then harvest them in the spring. And that cool weather, that long period of cool weather, really is best for developing really good flavor. So, it's not practical in most of the northern regions of the country to do that. But it's good to know. And the other thing was hot peppers. I always try and grow peppers that are hot but not too hot. And peppers are influenced by environmental. Well, one is, once again, the variety. And the other thing is environmental factors. And generally, though this doesn't always happen, generally it's the peppers are stressed, like if it's cold or if they're under drought stress, this will make for hotter peppers, which seems sort of logical for some reason.
Yeah. Back to onions back to onions for just a second. Do you ever kind of miss some onions when you're harvesting in the fall, and then in the spring, here comes some onions popping up, even in this cold climates like we have?
Oh yeah, that's the main problem is that sometimes the onions, if they're over a certain size, they'll go to seed, in which case they just make a really tough seed stalk eventually. But initially just tender leaves come up. I actually tried something on that theme last year. You know, if you go to, say, a garden center and you buy onion sets, which are little onions,
yeah,
for planting, they're really easy to plant. I grow onions mostly from seed, which I start in February, but there's certain varieties I like to plant, some of the sweeter varieties. So last year I planted the onions seeds out in the garden very close, which made them so crowded that they didn't get big. So they were sort of like onion sets, although they were a little large for onion sets, and I planted them out in the spring. And actually, they're growing pretty nicely, and I'm wondering if they're going to, if they're over a certain size, they bolt and make the seed stalk and won't be good. But I'm wondering if these are going to do that, and maybe they won't.
I like to take those little green onions and throw them in some vinegar, and then just chomp on them later.
I actually miss onions this time of year, but there are plenty of sprouts around. And sometimes I'll pick a few leaves off the ones I'm growing to save for, storage onions.
Yeah. Yep. Beth in Nashville, Tennessee has a question. Hi, Beth.
Yeah. Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I tuned in a little late, so I'm not sure if your guest can actually help me, but maybe you or some of the listeners can help. This question is about roses. And we have rose plants in a westerly area where the sun gets the afternoon sun. And they were beautiful last year. The bushes are about 2 years old. And this year, the buds and the flowers are just drying up, shriveling up, turning brown, and there are no new buds that are forming on the plant.
Hmm. What's your zone there?
Oh, I don't know. We haven't been here that long. We're originally from Wisconsin. It's been very warm, earlier than normal, I think.
Yeah.
I really don't know.
What kind? Do you know what kind of rose it is?
I don't.
Like a hybrid tea or a...
What did they look like last year?
They were gorgeous.
But absolutely. What color, what size and so forth?
The bush is quite high, maybe 3-4 feet high, and the color is sort of a dark, not really red, but it's a dark, dark fuchsia color. And the flower in full bloom is maybe the size of a medium carnation.
Okay.
My guess is it's a hybrid tea rose.
Yeah.
And my guess is that hybrid teas often die back from not that much winter cold, is that the plant died back, and it might send up new shoots from near ground level. And I guess the problem is that most roses or hybrid tea roses are grafted, and if it's a grafted plant, the shoot might be of the rootstock, not the variety that you planted, in which case it won't make a particularly nice rose. But I would just leave it and see what happens and see if it makes a nice rose. And if it makes a rose that doesn't look like the one that you saw last year, I would kill the plant.
Yeah, dig it up and get rid of it. Put it in the compost. Thanks, Beth. Appreciate the call.
Also, if I could get back, I did look for some information on that. I hate to leave a stone unturned, on the grape pest.
Yes.
And there's a grape flea beetle. I guess I pictured a larger beetle, but the grape flea beetle does attack leaves and buds early in the spring. But it's a dark beetle, and it's only a tenth of an inch long, so it'd be like a little less than an eighth of an inch. So perhaps that's it. And there's no special control there if you get a pesticide registered for that. The other thing is, which it doesn't seem practical to me, is to clean up any mulch and things like that that they might overwinter in. But since I mulch thoroughly the ground every year beneath my grapes, that would not be practical at all.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks for remembering what I forgot, Lee.
Sometimes it pays to just do nothing and hope for better next year.
Yeah. Christina in Glenwood City, your turn now. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I have a couple of Rubbermaid horse water troughs. They're cracked on the bottom. And I'm wondering if they can safely be used as a raised bed, or will it release any type of potential toxin? And what is your advice regarding that?
I would say use them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see any problem.
Shouldn't be a problem. Go give it a shot.
The main problem is it's going to take a lot of soil to fill it up.
Yeah, that's, if it's a horse trough, could be a foot deep.
Yeah, and the other thing about the soil to fill it up is, first of all, make sure there's, you might want to actually drill holes on the bottom so you have good drainage.
Yeah.
And you might also want to use a lighter soil, more sandy soil, because if it's too heavy a soil, it's going to become waterlogged, even though it's, I don't know how deep it is, if it's 2 feet deep even.
Yeah.
It can get waterlogged. And I discussed that a little in my book about this thing called a perched water table, which often occurs, among other places, in the bottom of a flower pot. A water layer unavoidably builds up there. And if you have a very tight soil, like a clay soil, there's so many capillary attraction there that water table at the bottom gets too high and really takes up root space, and then the roots can suffer from not being able to breathe, essentially.
There we go. Thanks, Christina. And Beverly in Cedarburg, hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I have a possible remedy for the lady who called in about some animal possibly munching on her tomato plant.
Yeah.
I had recently planted one, and I had planted some marigolds around it because someone had said marigolds will deter the bunnies. I found later that possibly isn't true because the next day, three of the marigolds were gone out of around the tomato plant. But I went to my local garden center, and they suggested these little garlic plugs. They have a little metal implement inside that you just click this little opening, and this garlic scent comes out. And you can either plug them down into the ground around the pots or clip them on to the container or the leaves. And I planted some more marigolds, and they're still there. And I don't know if they don't like it, but they suggested that deer or rabbits do not like the smell of the garlic. So it's working for me. So well, I thought I would just call in for the lady and see if maybe that would help her.
All right. Thank you very much, Beverly, for calling. What do you think, Lee? It's working for Beverly.
Geez, I hate to be so contrary, I'm sure it works for some. Maybe it works in some instances, but I actually did try those, and they were not effective in my garden, at least.
No.
So it's worth a try. It's easy enough to use.
Yeah, that's for sure. Thanks, Beverly. Appreciate it. And Teresa in Seymour. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about tulips. We are wondering what you do with the tulips after the petals fall off. Do you chop the heads off, or do you just let them go to seed?
Well, if you want to have them be, right after this growing season is when they're going to replenish their energy for flowers next year. And the more energy they have, the better the flowers. And if you cut off the heads, then they won't put energy into making seeds. So it's better to do that. The only reason to leave the flower heads, I mean the seed heads, which aren't attractive anyway, is if you wanted to, you know, save seed and, you know, plant tulip seeds and see how they come out. But I would say generally cut them off.
So you cut the...
Don't cut off the leaves, though.
No. My neighbor, a couple of blocks over from where I live, I always cringe a little bit because that person always cuts all the leaves down after the tulips flower, and I think, oh, you're cutting away all that opportunity for the plant to store materials. Oh, my goodness. Lee Reich is our guest today. Lee is a PhD in horticulture, and he's written a number of books, Weedless Gardening, Landscaping with Fruit, and his latest book is called The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. And Lee's last name is spelled R-E-I-C-H. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lee Reich, author of a number of books, including The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. Great book, and I'm really pleased to have him with us today to talk about it and to answer your gardening questions. If you'd like to join in, the number is 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Lee, we have Anne in Madison with a question about or a comment about rose chafers. Anne, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, we have Concord grapes up at Endeavor, and rose chafers are the ones, are the bad guy there. They eat all the little grapes. They make lots of holes in the leaves, and I don't know what to do about them. They also attacked our apple trees. We had planted a couple young apple trees some years ago, and every year they would eat the leaves, and we lost both of the trees.
You're sure they're rose chafers?
Yes, they are. I looked them up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Lee, a comment?
Geez. I've experienced so few pests on insect pests on grapes that it's hard for me to recall what to do about them.
I was trying to think about any kind of organic control.
Yeah, I can't think of any organic. I mean, there's always the usual spraying, but it's always nice not to spray them. I'm stumped.
All right. And maybe somebody else has got some ideas, and we'll hope somebody calls in.
I know some people sometimes remove some by hand, but that, you know, depending on how many you have, that may or may not be feasible.
Yeah, it's a tedious process if you've got a lot of them, and certainly if they're attacking fruit trees, that's almost becomes impossible unless they're dwarf trees. So maybe somebody else has got an idea, and stay listening. We'll see what we can come up with. There are lots of master gardeners listen to this program, and we may have some advice. Robert in Amherst Junction, your turn. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Hi. So earlier in the program, you had mentioned that there was another way, other than pheromone traps, another way to trap the spotted leaf Drosophila.
Right,
correct?
Spotted wing Drosophila.
Oh, winged. Oh, okay, yeah.
Right.
Anyway, I don't have trouble with them, but I have a lot of apple trees. And And, you know, we're constantly trying to trap or figure out how to deal with apple maggots and plum curculio. And I'm just wondering, for apple, yeah. And the pheromone traps are very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a really difficult thing in a large orchard to afford, you know, three or four traps per tree when the traps are $5 a piece. So do you have another possible trapping mechanism for those?
Traps, I believe, are used for codling moth, which isn't one of the pests that you mentioned, and generally, in my experience, has not been a major pest. But there are traps for, you mentioned apple maggot, which can be a very serious problem. It can basically make, you know, in some areas, it will make 100% of the crop inedible. But there is an easy trap, cheap trap you can make. So apple maggot is attracted early in the season. It typically comes out in about a couple of weeks, and it's attracted to the reddest, you know, apple. So people years ago, about 30 years ago, an entomologist at University of Massachusetts developed these traps. Basically, they look like the reddest apples around, because there aren't that many red apples around in 3 weeks. And it was basically spheres coated with a sticky material, and you would hang one per tree. So if you have a big orchard, there'd be a lot of traps, although sometimes you could trap around the edge of the orchard. So you'd hang one per dwarf tree or a few per full-size tree, and you hang these in a tree, and they'll provide as good control as chemical control. What I'd start doing is, because it gets sort of messy, the material that you coat the trap with is called Tango Trap. You can buy it in any garden center. And it's really sticky. It'll stay sticky for weeks and weeks, which is good for trapping, but bad if you get it on your fingers. So what I start doing is I would go to the supermarket around now and buy some Red Delicious apples, which look very apple-like. And they don't taste that great. You know, they're super hard, but actually they're really good for trapping, so I put a wire through it. And I coat it with this Tango Trap, and I leave it hanging in the tree. And oddly enough, they last at least half the season, sometimes the whole season. But if they start to get too gnarly and not attractive enough for the apple maggot, you just get another one. And it's fairly cheap. And then at the end of the season, you can throw them in the compost pile or just do anything with them. And that's why I've controlled apple maggot very effectively.
Yeah.
You can get like over 90% control. The plum curculio that you mentioned is more of a problem. There are no good traps, as far as I know, for plum curculio. And this was always the sort of the bottleneck in trying to grow apples organically, because plum curculio can also wipe out a crop in that when it lays an egg in the fruit often drops when it's really small. So although sometimes the fruit will mature with the egg in it, and it'll crush the egg, and then there'll just be a little scar on the fruit, and it's fine to eat. But there is one organic spray that is quite effective for plum curculio, and that's a material with the trade name Surround. And basically it's just a type of specially formulated kaolin clay, which is non-toxic. One thing it does do, you have to put on really a heavy layer and maintain a dusty layer. So it gives the trees all look basically white. They look like, all the trees are white. Which sounds a little odd, but I know when people visit my garden, I had my apple trees coated with Surround. First thing they do is they ask what kind of tree it is, because it doesn't look like an apple tree. And then everybody sort of likes it. It's sort of a Mediterranean look. But that's what I would recommend for apple maggot and plum curculio.
There you go. Robert, right. Good luck. That's a lot less than $5 a trap, for sure. Few cents. There we go. Jim in Lone Rock, by the way, phoned in to say that the Japanese beetles have shown up and they are all over the place. And he's very discouraged and ready to cut down his grapes. So
I always hope for a better year, as I said. And actually, I my hopes were fulfilled, because years ago, well, I didn't have any Japanese beetles here until about 20 years ago. Then I got a few and I put up the traps to try and attract them. Then they started building up more, and I was attracting more than I was trapping. So I stopped doing that. And then about 5 years ago, they showed up at the usual time, and I, you know, picked a few off by hand, but I was braced for the worst, and then they disappeared. And that's happened every year since then. And they sort of come, and then a few show up, and then they leave.
Yeah, the populations go up and they go down, and a lot of it depends on winter, and a lot of it depends on amount of rainfall in the spring. There's different reasons for shifts in the population of Japanese beetles, for sure.
I don't know why they left here, but whatever it is, I hope it keeps up.
Randy in Merrill, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Randy.
Hello, I planted a bunch of kohlrabi, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, and broccoli this couple weeks ago and nursed them through the hot, dry weather. And we got about a half inch of rain the other day, and now most of my broccoli and cauliflower are wilting. And I'm thinking it might be fusarium.
I don't think they get fusarium. They do get maggots in their roots, and they get, there's a disease that causes the roots to swell. I would dig up a plant and look at the roots and see if you see any insects or any swellings on the root. Oh, clubroot. That's a disease that can cause a swelling of the roots. Either one of these things could cause the wilting. The other thing is that, and I mentioned this in the book, that watering to me is one of the most important things, and people often don't get it right. I would like dig down into the soil and see if the soil is in fact moist enough. If the soil, sometimes people water too much or too little and they're not sure what's going on. I have a friend that asked me what was wrong with his house plant, and I said, well, maybe you're not watering enough. And they said, well, I water all the time. So I said, well, maybe you're watering too much. And I do some consulting also. He said, you get paid for that? So what I would do is really either dig down into the soil, see if it's just check the moisture, first of all. And you can also buy like these very inexpensive, like the $10 or a probe. It's this thing, you put this metal probe into the soil, and then a dial, it says, moist, dry, or wet. And they're pretty accurate. So that's the way you don't have to dig down into the soil. So I would first dig down or get one of these probes and see what the moisture level is in the soil. And if the moisture level is fine, then I would dig up a plant and see what its roots look like. And if you see a big swelling indicating club root, you have to practice crop rotation. And also liming the soil can help with that. Mm-hmm. And if you see these cabbage maggots, you can put barriers up when you plant next time, not this time. Both the club root and the maggots, root maggots, there's not much you can do about it now.
Yeah. Those probes, my probe doesn't, I don't trust my probe. It doesn't work.
Maybe I have too much trust in mine.
Ken in Mayville has a question for you, so let's go there. Ken, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I heard on the lead up to the show about bagging apples for flavor on the tree. My espalier pears have finally gotten their first year of pears, and I was wondering if it's possible to do it for pears as well. And does it keep the insects out also? And how tight do I make the bags?
Yeah, I don't remember that we were talking about bagging, but I do bag my grapes. And I bag them so that I use paper bags, delicatessen bags, and it says delicious baked goods on the outside. And evidently, insects don't read because they don't go for it. But the bags could work for the grapes. For the pears. In my experience, and generally, pears have very few pests as problems as compared with apples. I mean, if you have I would try not bagging some at least, just to see if you need to bag them, and then if you do have to do it, when you bag them, you want to make sure there's no openings, because if it's an insect that's going to attack it, it'll find an opening. Is what they spend their lives doing.
Yeah. So it's going to have to be fairly tight around the stem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Ken. Appreciate it. Fox and Krivitz called to ask your opinion of hydroponic gardening.
Oh, geez. I have a very strong opinion about it. So one of my graduate degrees is in soil science from the University of Wisconsin. And that gave me a lot of respect for soil, both what's known and what's unknown. Hydroponics basically, I think, puts too much faith in science, where you concoct these solutions that are going to provide perfect nutrition for your plants, and then you think this is all you've done. You reproduce what Mother Nature has done, and I think that there's so much going on in the soil that I would not trust any scientific concoction to nourish plants, surely not plants that I was going to eat and nourish myself with. Besides that, the other downsides to hydroponics are there's a certain expense just because you need pumps, you need to buy the materials, containers, things like that. And it just seems like such a waste. We have a whole world full of soil out here. Why not just use soil that's evolved with plants, the microorganisms in the soil, the way moisture lives in the soil, plants have evolved to really grow well in this medium for eons. So why not use this? Another downside to hydroponics is if you get one of the things that people like about hydroponics is because you can avoid soil diseases. But the fact is there's a lot of organisms in the soil that help fight off diseases. So you have both, and you just have to make sure the balance by adding a lot of compost, things like that, you tip the balance in the favor of the beneficial organisms. In a hydroponic setup, if you do get a disease by some way into part of that and then water's circulated throughout the system, that disease will spread to all the plants. And I think people are attracted to hydroponics just because of the bells and whistles. You got pumps, you got gauges, you got motor, all sorts of things going on. But I find soil is just so fascinating in its complexity and what it does. So not there, a big fan.
There you go. Ron in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I got a question. I once heard that, that roses, you can prevent aphids from landing on roses by putting strips of metal foil, aluminum foil, because it reflects the sunlight and that disorients the aphids. They know enough that if they head away from the sun towards, I guess, any plant that's not reflecting sunlight, that they can, it disorients them and then they don't know where to land. I just wonder if something like putting metal foil on any kind of plant would repel other parasitic insects other than aphids. Have you heard about that?
I have heard about it with aphids. When you started out, I thought you were going to say something else, and I was getting all ready to be a curmudgeon again and debunk it. But no, the foil on the mulch might not look, like a regular garden, but it is effective against aphids. But I'm not sure about other pests. I mean, I guess it's worth a try if the pest problem is bad enough and you want to put foil on your soil.
Yeah, that's, why not? What, most gardeners like to experiment anyway.
Yeah.
So why not give it a try, Ron, and see what happens? What the heck?
Just don't put too much faith in it, because maybe it won't work, and then you'll lose your crop for something else. And then when you mention experiments, I tend to do a lot of little experiments too, but I always have to restrain myself. I once read a quote in this book called My Summer in the Garden, which was written in the late 1800s by one of my favorite writers, Charles Dudley Warner, who's a friend of Mark Twain. And it's not really a gardening book. It's somewhat of a political book, too. But he writes something to the effect, I've seen gardens which were all experiment, given over to every new thing, and which produced little or nothing to the owners except the pleasure of expectation. So I always try and restrain myself, like from testing this, testing that, not too much.
Ron,
it's interesting.
Yeah, Ron, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, I tell you, there's lots more we can talk about here. One of the things that I liked your section on grafting, you have some nice photos in there that explain and show grafting methods in your new book, and I appreciated that.
Yeah, grafting is really a lot of fun. It's I sometimes have workshops here at my garden, and every year I do a grafting workshop, and always get a lot of people just because it's so fascinating. Just join these plants together, and you get a whole new plant.
Yeah, it's really a lot. It takes a little bit of care.
Yeah, when I do the workshop, I do sort of like in my book. I start out with the science of what makes a graft take. What conditions are needed, and then, we provide those conditions, by making a certain kind of cut, by keeping moisture in, by binding it, keeping it steady, and then, I graft a lot of apples and pears every year, and I'll typically get, 95% take.
That's
fascinating. I always get excited when I see new buds and new shoots growing from my grafts.
Yeah. I don't blame you. What are some important things gardeners can learn from the study of natural science here in the last minute or so?
Some things. Jeez, the whole book is about that.
I know.
Well, they can learn about, a lot of people grow weeping cherries. Why do weeping cherries weep? That would be the science. And then sometimes they stop weeping. So what do you do as a practice? Well, first of all, how can you make a weeping? I talk about how you can make a weeping cherry. And then if your cherry stops weeping, why and how to correct it?
Yeah.
That's one thing. Another thing that I think is really important, as I said, especially these days, is how plants deal with drought and how to make it so that they can tolerate drought better.
Yep.
Basically, some of it involves, just watering correctly, but there's also, preparing the soil and the plants for drought way before a drought occurs.
All good tips, and there's a lot of really good information in your book, Lee, and it's always fun to talk with you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. It was certainly my pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Mine also. Thanks for having me.
Lee Reich, and his last name is spelled R-E-I-C-H. His book is titled The Ever Curious Gardener, and the subtitle, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. It's really a fascinating book. He's also written Weedless Gardening, and he's also written another book called Landscaping with Fruit. And he writes a gardening blog that you can find at LeeReich.com. LeeReich.com. Hope you can join us again on Monday. Peter Green will be my guest, and we'll answer questions from you about your computers, all kinds of things there. That's at 11 Monday on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.